Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Episode 161, Bleety Binafi. Bienvenidos, bitches, and thank you for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cis, able-bodied, white dudes.
What?
No, they just aren't. Nobody we talk about was at January 6th. Now, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news, I've been telling you this for years, the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
It's okay. She's one of the good ones. We forgive her.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294.
Nailed it.
And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops patron.
Yeah.
You can also support us by supporting our sponsors.
Yes, please support our sponsors.
Support our sponsors, y'all.
Amen.
Amen. Oh my God. This is why she's one of the good ones, y'all. Fix her a plate. Get that woman a plate.
So our goal is to do this gig full time so we can bring you more delicious content and patron only content. But yes, unfortunately, the only way we can do that is if the podcast is able to support us financially. And anything you can do to help us reach that goal is absolutely appreciated.
Amen, amen, amen. Also, if you can't support us financially, tell your friends, rate us. That helps the show grow and helps people like Tyler Perry down the street find out about us. And then just kidding.
Post about us.
So who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Samuel Little.
You hang guys- on, I have a sound effect. Wait a minute.
You guys been asking for us to cover this guy for a long time. A
lot of years.
Yeah, so now here we go. Samuel Little was a serial killer who confessed to having committed 93 murders between 1970 and 2005, at least 50 of which have been verified by law enforcement. He was convicted of 4 murders, some of which were solved using DNA analysis.
All right, but before we get into it, how you doing?
Not so great.
Oh, my friend.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is verging into
basura.
radical right territory. And my work situation, everyone's quitting. And I'm left holding the bag, so I'm struggling.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
That's hard.
It's hard. But on the bright side, we were on True Crime Binge with Bob Ruff, so check that out.
Yeah.
And there's an article coming out about us in Podcast Magazine. And both of those interviews were the most fun interviews we've done so far. We had a really good time talking to
I will say they were relaxed. We were laughing our asses off.
Yeah.
And it was just fun. And they were cool. They were cool dudes.
They were very cool dudes. Yeah.
And spoiler alert, Bob Ruff is a white man. And the dude who interviewed us for Podcast Magazine is also white. And what was cool to me is they acknowledged it.
Yeah.
And also they needed to hold classes for them, interested and willing to I'm up to learn. I got blind spots, and it was just really rad to talk to people who weren't
defensive
defensive or antagonizing us. They were just like, what do you got? And it was just fun, and we hope you guys check those out and like them. Yes, the world is a dumpster filled with shit and set ablaze.
Yep.
May I be excused? but hang in there, friend.
Thanks.
We'll make it or not. I don't know.
Something's gonna happen either way.
Yeah, either way. It'll get better or it won't. I don't know.
I don't know.
But yeah, we got to do a lot of really cool shit recently, and hopefully we get to do plenty more. Yeah. It's been, we're back from a break, and I'm like energized. I'm so excited to be back on the mic with you. And to see where we've come since June of 2018.
Yeah, true.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you believe it?
I don't believe it.
New York Times, Harper's Bazaar, CrimeCon this, CrimeCon that, all these amazing
opportunities
and friends and community and we're educating people, helping people learn while also having fun talking about true crime and really bad stuff. Really bad hombres.
Pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a blast. And Beth, if you had never bothered me at work to do this
so
podcast.
When are we going to do that podcast?
this woman is real serious about doing a podcast. Okay. And here we are, and I am overjoyed. It's amazing to be here. So
it is. Yeah.
Hang in there, my friend.
We
can do it if we stick together. I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe. So now it's time to get into some listener letters.
Hello, angels.
Thank you. Ah, yes. What the hell is in that bag? What you got in that bag, Beth? What's in the bag?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you to Kimmy Livy, Maria, and Akila Oda for your 5-star reviews.
Oh, yes. Excuse me, y'all. Y'all got some hip-hop air horns coming your way.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
We got some new Patreons over the break.
Yeah.
And we are so grateful for all of you who've been rocking with us throughout the past 4 years and over million plus downloads and all the stuff. And for the new ones, here are your tunes. I hope you don't hate them. Real quick, your names are Rebecca D, Brooke C, Amanda P, and Christina W. Okay. Rebecca. Shittily baba whoa. Thanks, Rebecca. Okay, and Brooksy, this is for you. Thank you, Brooke, you know. Thank you, Brooke, you know. And I'm telling every fruity, all the fruities. I'm telling all the fruities. Thank you, Brooksy. And Amanda P. And if we only could, we'd make a damn good pod. And we'd get him to swap our places. Be running up that road. Be running up that hill. True crime with Amanda. Yeah, yo. Been really into Stranger Things over the break. Oh, my gosh. Okay. And Christina, this is for you. Oh, Christina, a Patreon. We're getting on and we've got you, girl, to rely on. So tell me when the true crime begins. Christina's tired and we need podcasts not to end. And those are for you. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
For supporting our show. So real quick, before we get into our episode, it's been a while since we brought this up, but we'd like to take a moment to say that this is a podcast about true crime and people of color and marginalized folks.
Yeah.
True crime is difficult to talk about or hear about sometimes. And race and oppression and all those things, women's rights, all those things can be difficult to talk about too.
Yeah.
But it's just part of the world that we live in. And as global citizens, we all have to talk about this stuff and we all get to talk about this stuff. And we want this to be a safe space where we can have fruitful discussions about all of the things. And we are all learning all the time. Sometimes we will make mistakes, but we just cop to it, learn from it, and keep it moving on our collective quest to be our best sexy selves.
Yeah.
Can't talk about it. Can't fix anything if we don't talk about it. So that's right. What we're here to do.
And we welcome our listeners to be a part of the conversation on Facebook or Twitter at Fruit Loops Pod, or email us at fruitloopspod@gmail.com.
Or call us at 602-935-6294. All right. Let's take a quick break and then we'll get into the story when we come back. All right. So we're back. Oh, I was just thinking about at CrimeCon and we met Janet. And do you remember Janet? She called. And I had been answering the phone because I didn't want to miss any vendors. And we talked and it was even lovelier to meet her and her wife in person.
Oh, that was awesome.
And
yeah.
It was, she's been a day one and she said something that I will never forget. She was like, I've been with you guys since you started the show and you would say, we've had this, let's take a quick break in the show since the beginning. It's in the script. And she was like, you guys used to take a break, but there would be no commercial.
There'd be nothing there.
Oh, yeah. So Miss Janet, yeah. If you're out there listening, we love you and all our day ones. Anyway, we appreciate y'all so much. So we're back. Remind us, Beb, who is our subject today?
Our subject today is Samuel Little, a Black man and the most prolific serial killer in U.S. history that we know of.
Oh, because there could be more?
There could be more.
Serial killers or victims?
Serial killers and victims.
Oh, okay. Bars. Okay. OG of true crime is flexing, everyone. Now it's time to get into some stats. All right. So, a.k.a. Samuel Little, also went by Sam McDaniel, Samuel McDowell, Willie Mae Clifton, and Willie Lewis. So he lured women with promises of money, drugs, doing drugs. It's been a long time since I said that. Yeah. I had to stop saying it in my house because my kids were repeating it.
They were starting to
Yeah. Whoops. his MO was to sucker punch the victim, then strangle her to death. Without any obvious signs of trauma, such as a stabbing or gunshot wound, many of the deaths were attributed to drug overdoses, accidents, or natural causes. He once punched a woman so hard that he broke her spine.
Jesus.
Wow. Little chose to kill marginalized and vulnerable women who were often involved in sex work and struggling with poverty and addiction. And he admits to this. Like, this was very intentional.
Yep.
Their bodies sometimes went unidentified and their deaths uninvestigated. Although Little confessed to a total of 93 murders, he was only convicted of the murders of Carol Eileen Elford, Guadalupe Duarte Apodaca, Audrey Nelson Everett, and Denise Christie Brothers. Rest in power, Queens. Authorities eventually put together a timeline that tracked Samuel Little's activities across the country since his birth. It is 24 pages long.
Yikes.
Unfortunately, that's a lot of pages. Yeah. He had too many victims to name, which is And that's too many stories for us to cover.
Yeah.
But please check out our links in the show notes to find out more about the victims.
Yeah.
With that said, we're going to dive into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Little was born in Georgia, but brought up in Lorain, Ohio. Lorain is located in northeastern Ohio on Lake Erie at the mouth of the Black River, about 30 miles west of Cleveland.
Cleveland rocks. Yeah. So the first historical records of Native Americans in Ohio came from French missionaries who entered into the region in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Entered into the region seems too benign
invaded
for what really happened.
Region. Yeah.
So from these missionaries, historians know that six major groups of Native Americans lived in Ohio and its neighboring states: the Shawnee in southern Ohio, the Seneca Cayuga in central and northwest Ohio, the Lenape in eastern Ohio, the Wyandot in northern Ohio, the Ottawa in northwest Ohio, and the Miama in western Ohio.
French land surveyors and fur traders had contact with Native Americans for many years, trading guns and weapons for furs and other supplies to send back to Europe. However, France never had permanent settlers attempting to farm and live in Ohio, so the French traders and Native Americans lived more or less peacefully for decades.
Okay, but in the mid-18th century, the British began to compete with French traders. British surveyors began to move into what would become Ohio and Kentucky, and to threaten Native American land much more aggressively than the French had. Not to mention they carried a shit ton of diseases.
Yeah.
Anyway, there were many struggles between France and Britain leading to the Seven Years' War, known in North America as the French and Indian War, which took place from 1753 to 1763.
The Native Americans, though disenchanted with the French, sided with them as they preferred them to the British. But the British won the French and Indian War and assumed control over all former French lands east of the Mississippi River. Consequently, treatment of Native Americans in Ohio began to change for the worse.
So this was intended as a culture corner. So Negro soldiers loyal to either colonizer side, there were Black soldiers who were on the French side and on the British side, fought and were loyal to either colonizer side, all hoping that by contributing to the white fight, they could finally earn their liberation. This time, I'm going to show them that I could do this, and it still hasn't happened. Anyway, although throughout Black people and Indigenous people's history, together within the Americas, there are more stories of acceptance and kindness towards each other. However, it should also be noted that there are stories of the two antagonizing each other because of these wars created by the white people.
Right.
They had to go in and do a job and essentially kill each other. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. And there are accounts of Native Americans locating escaped enslaved people to return them to the white human traffickers who owned them, or in other instances, Black soldiers obeying white folks' orders and helping to remove natives from their lands in the name of imperialism. It's crazy when you think of Indigenous folks as people whose land was stolen and the Black soldiers who were stolen from their land. Yeah.
Boom. That, my edges.
Yeah.
Can I have them back, please? Wow. That last bit blew me away. White people began to move into and settle in the Western lands, provoking a series of wars that eventually pushed Native Americans further west. Before 1830, various Native American tribes had voluntarily moved west. Those tribes had negotiated treaties and handled the terms and details on their own.
Then the Indian Removal Act was signed into law by President Andrew Jackson, your favorite.
On May hate him so 18, much.
1830. It gave the president the power to force Native American tribes to move to land west of the Mississippi River. The Native Americans in Ohio were forced to give up their land claims and were removed from their homes to locate to Kansas and Oklahoma, where they were promised, quote unquote, better land. It wasn't better.
Mm-mm.
Many Native Mm-mm. American people died along the way.
Yeah. And then also when they got there, they were moved even more. So
yeah. And some of them were moved to reservations that were already being inhabited by other Native American tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a clusterfuck. It was terrible.
Just a mess. And still, the United States has not reckoned with this
any of this
genocide
any
and
of this
land theft.
Yeah.
So happy 4th of July.
Yeah.
No. So the last Native American nation to leave Ohio were the Wyandot, who were removed to a reservation in Kansas in 1843. Although there were numbers of individual Native Americans throughout the state who remained in Ohio. As of the 20th century, there are no Native American reservations and no federally recognized Native American tribes in Ohio. That is
crazy.
I can't even believe it. Yeah. I can't wrap my mind around it. This is their land.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to speak of essentially on the record.
Yeah.
For present day, as far as representation in Ohio. That's fucked up.
Yeah.
God, I hate it here.
So Lorraine was first known as Black River, and it was incorporated as the village of Charleston in 1836 and then renamed in 1874 after Lorraine County, which in turn had taken its name from the province of Lorraine, France.
Oh.
Lorraine is Ohio's 10th largest city and the second largest in the greater Cleveland area and the largest in Lorain County. Cleveland is in Cuyahoga County.
Hmm. Yeah, not sounds like if I were to go there, I'd probably need to bring a whole suitcase full of seasonings in case I had to eat something.
I think there's a lot of Black people living there now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I think you'd be all right.
Okay. Whew. Boy, oh boy. Don't play with me about my seasonings now. Prior to the Civil War, Ohio was a leading state for enslaved Black people traveling the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad was a network of people, both Black and white, allyship, y'all, who offered shelter and aid to people escaping slavery from the South. Specific dates of its existence are unknown, but it operated from the late 18th century through the Civil War.
The Ohio River is the boundary of the Midwestern and Southern United States. However, crossing the Ohio River was no guarantee of freedom. Actually, no land in the United States was safe because Fugitive Slave Acts were passed by the federal government, which authorized local governments to seize and return escapees to their owners and imposed penalties on anyone who aided in their flight.
This sounds awfully familiar to what's in the news lately with women's rights.
Yeah.
How anybody who aids somebody fleeing something really fucked up can
get in trouble.
Get into trouble.
Yeah.
God damn America. So the goal was to get to Canada. In Ohio, their final stop was a Lake Erie port community in the north from which they could escape to Canada. Lorraine became known as Station 100 of the Underground Railroad. For some people, it was their last stop until freedom. Captain Aaron Root, who sailed from Lorraine, made extra room for escaped enslaved people on ships crossing Lake Erie.
Ohio became a state in 1803. Although slavery was not allowed in Ohio as part of its constitution, Black people were not treated as equals to white people in the new state due to their racist beliefs and concerns about economic competition. Many white Ohioans were not willing to grant rights to Black people. As a result, the Ohio legislature launched a coordinated campaign to prevent fugitive slaves and freed Black people from settling in the state, passing Black laws to discourage them.
Wow. We're not willing to grant rights.
Nope.
But why? What does it do to you?
Because they didn't want the competition and they're racist fucks. That's why.
I guess it's not a zero-sum game, you fools. enacted between 1804 and 1807, Ohio's Black laws sought to restrict the movement and freedom of Black people already living in the state. So they also denied all Black people the right to public education and required Black people to register with local authorities and prove their freedom on demand.
Within 20 days of arriving in Ohio, Black people seeking residence there were required to post a $500 bond guaranteed by two white men. Other laws restricted Black people from competing economically with white Ohioans. An 1807 law fined any white person for hiring a Black person who did not possess proof of freedom. The laws also limited their rights to marry white people and to gun ownership.
This also reminds me, again, I keep hearing, especially a lot, lately, this isn't our country. This is not America. We don't do this. But this reminds me a lot of how we treat immigrants.
Yeah.
Show me your papers.
Right.
Are you registered to be here? Do you belong here?
Yeah.
And it's just... So they also prohibited black people from, I'm going to be so mad. I'm going to be shouting by the end of this episode. They also prohibited black people from testifying in cases involving white people as parties. As a result, for the next four decades, white people could act with impunity in filing baseless civil lawsuits against black people barred from testifying to defend themselves.
That's fucked up.
Ugh, the worst. And again, not that different from how the courts operate today. And committing crimes against black people with no fear that the victim or any black witness would be permitted to give evidence against them. Mm.
This law made black people vulnerable to exploitation and abuse and ensured that they could not rely on the courts for protection or justice. During this period, the Colored American, a black newspaper in Cincinnati, reported numerous examples of white people swindling money from black people, and also highlighted cases in which authorities failed to prosecute white-on-black violence after this law kept black eyewitnesses from testifying.
I'm just going to insert a thought here. I've heard sometimes other brown and black immigrants look down on African-Americans because it might appear that black Americans have been granted so much because you're born here. You're born in the land of the free, the home of the brave, man. But while that could be true, imagine making all these efforts.
It absolutely didn't start that way.
No, but imagine making all of these efforts, right? Because what it is African Americans were born here, and then black and brown immigrants had to make the journey to get here. And then once they get here, they have to do all this work to make it.
Right.
But black people already, African Americans are already
here.
They're
already here.
So you already overcame that hurdle. But imagine being here, and every time you take steps forward, everything you built gets burned to the ground.
Yeah.
And stripped away from you. So progress is intentionally stifled.
Kind of strips you of hope.
Yeah, you are a particular type of black when you are an African American, as opposed to a black or brown immigrant from another place who may not necessarily face the same hurdles in the same way.
Right.
There we go.
Yeah. It's just two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Culture Corner, I'm done. In 1841, after two white men murdered a black man named Charles Scott in his home, a white judge relied on the law to prohibit Mr. Scott's widow, an eyewitness to the murder, from testifying at the trial. Although the men were convicted after the judge admitted the testimony of a different eyewitness, whom the judge deemed white enough. Oh my God. Jeez. The testimony law, which prioritized white supremacy over justice, was on the books for 42 years and was not repealed until 1849.
Man, that is fun.
Injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The black laws and other policies did deter some African Americans from settling in Ohio. But Lorain's location next to Lake Erie and the early arrival of the B&O Railroad in 1871 made the city a hub for industry. And by the latter half of the 19th century, many black settlers had chosen to come to the area.
Although the black laws were finally abolished in 1886, there were still unwritten social rules dictating black lives in Ohio, such as where they could sit in a theater, where they could go, and who they could associate with.
At the beginning of the 20th century, as World War I began, there was a shortage of workers in industrial jobs in the North, Midwest, and Western urban areas. Northern recruiters and black newspapers encouraged black people to leave the South for the North and the West.
Known as the Great Migration, it is normally broken up into two migrations. The first Great Migration, which occurred from 1910 to 1940, and the second Great Migration from 1940, around when Samuel Little was born, to 1970. The two are separated by the low levels of migration during the Great Depression.
Between the years of 1916 to 1970, more than 6 million Black people relocated from the rural South to cities in the North, Midwest, and West. However, their new lives did not come without difficulties. Men's jobs were usually in dangerous and strenuous working conditions, while women had trouble finding work. There was competition for housing, along with racism and prejudices, and rents surged as cities became increasingly crowded.
Lorraine and Cleveland both saw large increases in their African-American population during the second Great Migration as Black folks arrived looking for better opportunities at the plants operating in Lorraine.
During World War II, Lorraine's shipyard was put to work by the government to build the USS Lorraine, a warship. The United States Steel Mill began as the Johnson Steel Company in 1894. It stretches for nearly 3 miles on the city's south side. These mills operated in the city from 1895 to 2016 and employed thousands of local residents. Lorraine also became home to a Ford Motor Company assembly plant, which operated from 1958 to 2005.
Oh, interesting. Lorraine's non-white population in 1940 was less than 2%. By the 1950 census, it was nearly 5%. The 2010 census shows Lorraine at 17.6% for persons who identify as Black or African American alone, and 5.4% that identify as two or more races. Lorraine's poverty level is above the national average, but lower than Cleveland's.
Fun fact, novelist and Nobel laureate Toni Morrison was born in Lorraine.
Round of applause for Toni Morrison. Un aplauso to the GOAT. Yes, indeedy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's better, HELP.com/fruit.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
Hi, Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and...
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
All right. Well, now we're going to get into the early life of Samuel Little. So Samuel Little was born on June 7th, 1940 in Reynolds, Georgia, a small town about 100 miles south of Atlanta. By the way, it's not pronounced Atlanta. It's pronounced Atlanta.
Atlanta. Atlanta.
Don't say the T's. Atlanta.
Atlanta. Yeah. Atlanta.
Atlanta. Okay. Yes. There you go. So details from his childhood were unclear. His mother, Bessie Mae Little, was 16 when she gave birth to Samuel, and a 1940 census listed her occupation as a maid, which, by the way, was one of the few occupations Black women were allowed to have at that time. Samuel Little has said that his father was a 19-year-old named Paul McDowell, but it sounds like he wasn't involved in his life much at all.
Little has claimed that his mother was a sex worker who, as a teenager, abandoned him as an infant by the side of the road. Whether that's true or not, we don't know, but it's probably how he felt, abandoned. Sam, or as his family called him, Sammy, was raised mostly by his paternal grandmother, Fannie Mae McDowell, in Lorain, Ohio. Lorain, Ohio is a suburb of Cleveland, and both cities saw large increases in their Black population during the second half of the Great Migration, which took place from 1940 to 1970.
By the way, foreshadowing... if I was going to take a test on Samuel Little and this was the text, I would highlight everything Beth just said. Anyway, Sammy was a troubled teen who didn't do well in school. At the age of 13, he was reportedly committed to the Boys Industrial School, a reformatory for teenage boys in Lancaster, southeast of Columbus. His booking card listed him under the last name of his grandparents, McDowell, and said he was there for stealing. He later said that he had stolen a bike. His IQ was listed as 96. Is that high?
It's average.
It's regular?
Yeah, okay. It's regular. Yeah. By the time Sammy was released to his grandparents in September of 1955, he had racked up 47 disciplinary reports. Most of the other boys averaged one or two. He eventually dropped out of school while he was in junior high.
According to Little, he began having sexual fantasies about strangling women as a child, starting when he saw his kindergarten teacher touch her neck. He also said that as a teenager, he collected true crime magazines depicting women being choked. And by the way, I didn't realize there was true crime magazines in the 50s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What?
People have been fascinated with true crime since like day one.
Since the beginning of time.
Yeah,
since the caveman
really.
Days.
It's nothing that... I mean, it's we have a lot of resources now to... there's a lot of venues where we can
partake in...
true crime stories and stuff like that. But there was like yellow journalism way back when, and when Jack the Ripper was active, like people just gobbled that up, you know.
Really? I didn't realize that people were into it at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that...
I mean, why wouldn't they be?
I don't know. I mean, I know I would be. I know I would. I don't know about y'all, but me. But I just think that's so cool. That this genre is it's almost I feel like it's a mark of our humanity.
Yeah. I think so too.
This fascination with it.
Yeah.
So
I think so too. It's
that's just what
normal,
I'm gonna say.
I think.
Even though I am a sick fuck, but I believe
I
this makes
fucks.
Me human. Yes.
On November 29th, 1956, when he was just 16, Little was arrested for burglary in Omaha, Nebraska. After serving time for that at a youth authority, he was released. A few months later, he was arrested again for breaking and entering. He then served time at the Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield.
He was paroled from Mansfield after a few years, but then sent back in October 1961 for breaking into an abandoned furniture warehouse in Elyria. He was paroled from Mansfield again in December of 1964. Mansfield was closed by court order in 1990 due to overcrowding and inhumane conditions.
You don't say.
Of course, yes. The prison is best known as the filming location for the Shawshank Redemption.
Yep.
What?
I knew you'd like that.
Oh my God, I love that fact. Oh my God, I'm hugging myself because that just brings me so much joy. I love that movie.
Samuel Little grew to be 6'3", and it's been remarked by more than one person, many people actually, that he had very large hands and they were perfect for strangling.
Oh, Grandma, what big hands you have. Oh, yes, my dear. The better to
strangle you with.
I don't know. I don't know why I thought of that. Sorry. Forgive me. Yeah, I'm terrible. So now it's time to dive into the timeline. So from the time Little dropped out of school and left his Ohio home in the late 1950s, he lived a nomadic life. He lived out of his car and would shoplift and steal to gather the money to buy alcohol.
Doing drugs.
But he never stayed in one place for too long.
Little was arrested again in 1966 for assault and battery after attacking a woman in Cleveland. Around this time, he got married in Lorraine, but we don't know her name, and the union did not last. In his late 20s, Little went to live with his mother, who had moved to Florida. There, he reportedly worked at the Dade County Department of Sanitation, at a cemetery, and as an ambulance attendant.
Interesting jobs.
Yeah.
It was in Miami. By the way, I would love to work at a cemetery or a mortuary. Can you imagine Beth and Wendy funeral home?
I had thought about at one time working at a mortuary.
Me too. But, oh my God, we have to do this.
But I don't think I could handle it. All the sadness.
Yeah. Oh, geez. I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
That actually
would be hard.
When my mom died, the funeral home was just really good. And they helped a lot. And I was like, oh, I want to help people too. And then later on, I was like, oh, no. I mean, I do want to help people. I wish, you know, I want to comfort people and stuff. But I think it would get to me.
Yeah. Maybe it would be. But I've had this thought since I was a teenager of this, you know, having a funeral home. And I know that segregation is it's as American as apple pie. Even the cemeteries were segregated. So there are many funeral homes that are still operating today that when they were segregated, catered to black people only.
Yeah.
Because they weren't allowed to be buried in white cemeteries.
Right.
And I just think it's a cool aspect of American history that I would love to be a part of that tradition in a weird way.
Right.
I feel weird saying this out loud. I'm almost embarrassed. Like I just,
why?
I don't know. I feel silly saying that out loud. Anyway, don't pretend to me. It was in Miami in the early morning hours of New Year's Day, 1971, that Little committed his first confirmed murder. He met Mary Brosley at a bar on New Year's Eve, 1970. In the early hours of 1971, they drove to a deserted stretch of road near the Florida Everglades, where Little strangled Mary to death and then buried her in a shallow grave. Hey, by the way, it doesn't look like he had any military service.
No.
Didn't have to serve in Vietnam.
Not that I know of. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Between 1957 and 1975, Little, who sometimes went by the name Samuel McDowell, was arrested by police officers 26 times in 11 states, including Ohio, Maryland, Florida, Massachusetts, California, Oregon, Philadelphia, New Jersey, Arizona, Illinois, and Georgia.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Ohio, Maryland, man. Oh, my God. That's a lot of states to get locked up by the police.
Yep. And charges included shoplifting, theft, assault, rape, aggravated assault on a police officer, DUI, fraud, breaking and entering, and solicitation. During his stints in the penitentiary, he started boxing and he learned to draw.
In 1971, he met Aurelia Jean Dorsey in a Cleveland jail. The jail was reportedly so run down that inmates could talk through holes in the walls and ceilings. A woman 30 years his senior little later said that Jean was quote unquote no beauty, but he admired her loyalty and her shoplifting skills. Should have said skills. And the two took up together. To make money, Jean Dorsey would shoplift and Little would fence the goods.
Little later described Jean Dorsey as a shoplifting expert, his traveling companion, and a surrogate mother. Little referred to her as his quote-unquote old lady. As they traveled from state to state, Little and Dorsey settled into a routine. After Dorsey went to bed, Little went out to hunt for victims.
Mm. From Little's later confessions, it seemed as though Dorsey was never involved with any of the murders, although it had been reported that she often cleaned his car, which many times was the murder scene, so she may have been aware of what he was up to. It's also been reported that he often beat her, so if she was aware, it would be no wonder why she would not say anything about it.
Yeah, and she was, so he was like 30 when they met, and she was 30 years older than him, so she was like 60.
Wow,
so,
okay,
you know,
okay. Yeah.
She was probably, well, 60's not that old, but, no. You know, since I'm
but comparatively,
approaching 60.
Yeah. compared
but
to...
But you're just not as spry as you are when you're younger, so yeah, she was vulnerable.
Yeah, but I bet, I'm sure there's a lot of wisdom there. Also, it is interessante. Oh, I lost my thought. What were we just talking about? Oh, I know. You mentioned abandonment earlier.
Oh,
and
his
mom, he felt abandoned her. So it kind of makes sense that he would latch or
onto
connect
somebody who
onto
is
somebody
loyal
older.
And yes. Loyal. Yeah.
And maternal. Yes.
Yes. Yes. That does make a lot of sense. Yep. So Little's grandmother, Fannie Mae McDowell, died in 1972, followed by his mother, Bessie Mae, in 1973. And no article that I found mentioned anything about how that affected Samuel.
Mm. Well, it sounds like from interviews, which I'm sure by now many of us have all seen interviews of Samuel Little.
Yeah.
He only tells you what he wants you to hear. Right.
Yeah.
And so
and who
that
knows
might,
if that's true or not.
Yeah. And yeah. So that might be a vulnerability of his and why he didn't bring it up.
Yeah. He never really talks about his mom or his grandmother, at least that I've seen. It may be that he talked about them, but that didn't get aired because nobody cares, but I care.
I'm certainly interested.
Yes,
but it also reminds me of the interviews we've seen of him where he does not want to be referred to as a rapist, right?
Yes.
Like, I am this, so I'm going to talk to you about this part. I will shut
the
fuck up
part.
If you try to tell me that I am something other than what I tell you that I am.
Yeah.
So, it just seems like one of those things. If it did affect him, he kept it real close to the vest.
He's not going to tell you about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On January 18th, 1975, the body of a woman was found in a wooded area in eastern Knox County, Tennessee, by two hunters. She was bruised and nude from the waist down. Her pantyhose and girdle bunched around her knees. Her purse and some of her jewelry were missing. Her body appeared to have been dragged into the woods and dumped behind a pine tree.
The woman was identified as Martha Cunningham, 34, who had last been seen on New Year's Eve of 1974, heading to an evening prayer service at her church. Martha was a talented singer and pianist who grew up performing with her parents, Mary and Clyde Lane, and her six younger siblings in a gospel group known as the Happy Home Jubilee Singers.
Ooh, that just sounds like it would be
a fun
group to listen to. Despite the evidence at the scene, within a day of the discovery, detectives attributed Martha's death to natural causes. What woman goes to the woods to die?
And takes all her clothes off.
And takes all of her clothes off?
No.
The medical examiner. I'm sorry. The medical examiner really fucked this one up. But their investigative report lists the probable cause of death as unknown. So quick side note about medical examiners' offices in the United States. They're problematic because they make mistakes that lead to inaccurate conclusions about a crime such as this. And it leads to crimes not being solved, people getting off, the wrong people getting convicted. And like many things in America, MEs offices are bad players in a really fucked up system. Not all MEs are medical examiners are board certified in forensic pathology. And there is apparently a huge shortage of forensic pathologists qualified to be MEs.
Should have gone into that.
Yeah. Well, part of it has to do with the training because you have to go to regular medical school. Mm. Then you have to do a residency. And then I think you also have to do a fellowship, which is like an extra few years.
Right.
So it's a lot of school. It's a lot of debt. And many municipalities that need to fill these important roles with somebody qualified just don't have, there's just not enough people. Yeah. But that also means that the person who does get the job and whose job it is to determine how people die and gets the final say-so on if a death is a homicide, a suicide, or an accident or natural causes isn't a doctor and isn't qualified to do it.
Yeah.
So there
it's a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
On September 11th, 1976, in Sunset Hills, Missouri, a woman began banging on the back door of a home, crying for help. She was naked below the waist with her hands bound behind her back with an electrical cord and cloth. When the police arrived, the woman, who identified herself as Pamela K. Smith, told officers that she was picked up by a man in St. Louis. She said he choked her from behind with an electrical cord, forced her into his car, beat her unconscious, and then drove to Sunset Hills and raped her.
Officers found Little, then 36, still seated in his car near the home. What? With Pamela's jewelry and clothing inside. Little denied raping the woman, telling officers, quote, "I only beat her," unquote.
Oh, my God. I just beat a lady. Yeah. I mean, what?
Yeah. And next question. In December of 1976, Little was found guilty of assault with the intent to ravish rape. And that's a new charge I haven't seen. And was sentenced to 3 months in county jail.
It has to be rape? One of those old-timey things.
Wow.
Ravish raped.
I guess so. Rape. I wonder if that's just a name that they gave to black men. Because that's white men's worst fear.
Ravish.
Yeah. I mean, think of Birth of a Nation where rather than getting raped, the white lady jumps off a cliff. Then getting raped by a black man. Anyway.
A detective who later reviewed the Smith case believes that Little may have pleaded to a lesser charge and received a shorter sentence because of the victim's lifestyle. The case file refers to Pamela as a heroin addict who often failed to appear in court.
What does that matter?
I don't know. They're just evaluing the victim.
Yeah, but it also sounds victim blamey.
Oh, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Devaluing her as a person.
I thought you said evaluating. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Devaluing.
Thank you. Yes.
You know, sometimes we do these episodes and I think you say one thing. And then when I'm editing, I'm like, oh, that's what she said. That's funny.
Oh, my gosh. Let me make sure these headphones are in my actual ears. Wait, they don't go on your forehead? So on August 16th, 1982, the body of Rosie Hill was found in the woods in Ocala, Florida. She had been strangled to death. She had last been seen leaving a bar with a man. Little later said that he was almost caught when he killed Rosie when a police officer came up to his car after he'd strangled her to death.
Little jumped out of the car and pretended like he and his lady friend had just been caught in a sexual act. Meanwhile, Rosie lay dead in the car. The officer was looking for burglary suspects, so after seeing a naked woman in the car, he just told Little to move along and left the scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
In September of 1982 in Pascagoula, did I say that right? Pascagoula, Mississippi. Crooked letter, humpback, a woman named Melinda Rose LaPree went missing after getting into a brown wooded panel station wagon with a man. wooden panel station wagon. Just the idea of it makes me smile. Anyway, this is not a smiling story. Mindy has been described as brilliant and a musical genius who could teach herself to play any instrument she wanted. But her mother died when she was just 7 and her father had become extremely abusive.
So as a teenager, Mindy decided to run away from the abuse and ended up in Pascagoula. There, she started doing drugs.
Doing drugs!
Doing drugs! While her boyfriend, quote, pimped her out for money, unquote. Despite attempts to get her to return home, and I believe it was her siblings who were trying to get her to come home.
Oh, okay.
She stayed in Pascagoula doing odd jobs, even working on shrimp boats, as well as selling drugs and engaging in sex work. Shortly before her death, she gave birth to a son.
Doing all the things she could to survive.
Yeah.
Police initially wrote off Mindy's disappearance because of her lifestyle, which is basura.
Yeah.
What lifestyle? She's a child, essentially, trying to survive.
Yeah.
In a really, really hard world.
Yeah.
This understandably infuriated Mindy's brother, Bob. And in October of 1982, skeletal remains were found in a Gautier, Mississippi cemetery. Bob says that he had to push for testing on the body, which was just sitting in a morgue. But after work with an anthropologist and through the use of dental records, Bob LaPree learned that the body was in fact his sister.
In November of 1982, Little was arrested for shoplifting in Pascagoula, and police realized that he matched the description of the suspect in Mindy LaPree's murder. And during the investigation, two sex workers came forward to allege that Little had assaulted them in Pascagoula in 1980 and in 1981.
The first to tell her story was a woman who was living in the Carver Village neighborhood in Pascagoula in 1980. The woman said she was working along a street known as the Front, where sex workers gathered to keep an eye out for each other for safety reasons.
It was a hot night in July when she said Little picked her up outside of a nightclub. She took him back to her place in the village. As soon as he shut the door, the woman said Little grabbed her neck and started choking her before he knocked her unconscious.
When she came to, Little was on top of her, beating and choking her. She passed out and then woke up with her body submerged in her tub and naked with the exception of a scarf around her neck. She said the man used the lace scarf to yank her head in and out of the water.
Oh, jeez.
Playing with her like a toy.
Yeah.
Punching her when he pulled her and then forcing her back underwater.
Oh, my God. That's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
She told authorities she lost consciousness and woke later to find herself in the hospital and unable to talk or communicate. She initially reported she was attacked by a burglar because her parents came to the hospital and she didn't want them to know what she was doing for a living.
That's really sad.
It is.
The other woman was in her 20s and selling shoes out of her car and resorting to sex work to make money. In November of 1981, about a week before Thanksgiving, a man in a station wagon with wood paneling, later identified as Little, offered to pay her $50 for sex.
The woman got into Little's car, and before she knew it, the man cold-cocked her in the back of the head and then punched her again between the eyes and started choking her. The woman said she managed to escape a couple of times, but Little would catch her and drag her back to the station wagon.
That's horrifying.
Yeah.
At one point, she said a young boy on a bicycle saw them outside the car, and he asked if she was okay. Little claimed she was his wife and was drunk. She couldn't speak because of the relentless choking. Eventually, the woman said she escaped through a cargo area in the back of the car and ran across US 90 until she made it back to the village. She said some people took her to the hospital, but she never filed a police report.
In 1982, Little was arrested in Pascagoula, Mississippi, and charged with the murder of 22-year-old Melinda Rose LaPree and the assault of the two sex workers.
All right, y'all, that's where we are going to end it this week. We told y'all we tackled this one, and it's a hefty case. It's a long one. So we hope that you will come back next week to find out what happens next.
Yeah.
But now it's time to get into how not to get murdered. So it's been a while since I sang this.
It is.
I forgot the words. Just kidding. if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
So I started following at Chelsea Kyann, spelled C-H-E-L-S-E-A-K-Y-A-N-N on TikTok.
Okay.
And she gives amazing, quick self-defense video tips. Oh. And anyone who doesn't want to get murdered should follow.
Okay.
So that's subscribe at Chelsea Kyann. And she has a specific video that must have popped into my feed because, you know, our phones are watching us and listening to us and reading
at
our
all
minds.
Times, yeah.
Yeah. So knew that I was researching the Sam Little case. And there was a lot of there's a whole lot of choking going on in this mm-hmm. one. So she talks about what to do if you are choked. And the instinct is to try to grab the wrists or hands of the person who's choking you to get
right.
them off.
Right.
But she said, don't do that. Don't keep your chin high and your neck exposed. Instead, tuck your chin and shrug your shoulders high. Then karate chop those arms down and away from you. So that way you protect your neck and you also give yourself time to get away.
Okay.
The follow is Chelsea Kyann, but I did find a link, so I'll put a link in the description box so
All
you
right.
can see the video too.
Sweet.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, because I think I need to see it.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of hard to, this is an audio medium, and
yeah.
so it's a little hard to
describe
explain.
Exactly. Yeah, what's going on.
But once you see it, you'll be like, oh my God, I'm going to do that. Yeah.
yeah.
It, you know, God forbid you don't have to, but
yeah.
anyway.
Good to know,
so
though.
Now it is a shout out time where we shout out any content by people of color or any marginalized folks or any true crime goodies.
Okay.
So I have two true crime and BIPOC adjacent, a podcast called Reclaimed about Mammy Till, Emmett Till's mother. And the podcast recounts Mammy's early life, her son's early life, and as well as the horrific murder. And then after which, you know, she made the decision to say, I'm going to open casket.
Right.
We need to show the world what they have done to my baby.
Yeah.
And it kicked off the whole civil rights movement in the United States in the mid-1950s. And then it gets to kind of the woman she became after the lynching of her baby.
Wow.
And then, so that's Reclaimed. And then the second one is Speaking of Crimes, Will Be Wyatt.
Oh, yeah. That's a good
one. Have you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I just discovered it.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
my
awesome.
God.
Yeah.
It is an 8-part series about the forces that led to Coachella, aka January 6th. And I was riveted.
Yeah, it's really
oh,
good.
Oh, my God. Anyway, so what do you got, Beth?
Well, I wanted to shout out Star Trek Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus.
Oh,
so it's another Star Trek franchise.
But it's
the most similar to the original series than any other spinoff that I've seen.
And Whoopi Goldberg's in this one too?
No.
Oh.
That's not the original series. That one's
Next Generation.
Yeah. So the original series, the one with Kirk and Spock, you know.
Got you.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes.
So it's the most similar like to that show that any other spinoff.
Okay.
I think it's really
okay.
good. It's
okay.
my favorite show right now. It's
okay.
it's a prequel to the original series. So Uhura is a cadet in the series.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You know, black girls everywhere
love Uhura. Everybody
Uhura.
Loves Uhura.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And even Martin Luther King, girl, she was going to quit the show. She met Martin Luther King.
That. He
she met Martin Luther King. Said, yeah,
not
you can't quit this show. My
yeah.
daughters love this show. Oh my God. So,
and there are other characters who are people of color, and it's just, I just love it. And so, yeah.
I want to watch it now.
Soon as you get off of the microphone, you can
as
go
soon,
watch it.
Ooh, what sleep? What? I don't have to go to work tomorrow.
Sleep.
No way. Okay, so that is Star Trek Strange New Worlds on Paramount Plus. Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
Will Be Wyatt. Oh, God, you guys. It is wild.
It's wild, yeah.
And Reclaimed. Those are two podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Right. Golly. Well, so that's it for today, but we got more on this Samuel Little matter.
Yep. Yep.
When we come back next week. Yep. But in the meantime, where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
That's right. So this is a weekly podcast. Do you know what a podcast is? And new episodes drop every Thursday. Do you know what a Thursday is? So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Detective came and knocked on the door, and I said, "Is it Renee?" And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to season 2 of Proof wherever you get your podcasts and follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.